Hello, listeners, and welcome to Fighting Failure. We're back from our break, and this is the first episode of Season 3, Material World. In this season, we're going to be talking about the environmental issues associated with physical products, specifically materials. And we're going to have two topics in this season. The first, which we'll be getting today, is all about waste. And then the second topic, which will be led by Hisham later on in the season, is going to be about consumerism. So we're both really excited to talk about this, perhaps an issue that's more central to a lot of people's lives. If you look at the photos of what happens in like third world countries with the amount of waste that's everywhere, or the issues in first world countries with how much things people buy, this is a very applicable season, so we can't wait to share this with you. So today we are talking about why recycling is not all it's cracked up to be and what we can do to fix it. I'm your host, Oscar Archibald.
And I'm your co-host, Hisham Kanan.
And you're listening to Fighting Failure, the podcast where we discuss solutions to the climate crisis. So let's start with the problems with plastic recycling. Now, I think the biggest problem, as we can probably both say, is that most of what we put in the recycling bin is not recycled. And in fact, only 10% of all like recyclable plastic that's ever been produced has ever actually been recycled. Only 1/10. So say you throw out 10 yogurt pots, only one of them is actually getting turned into something new. So I think that is a pretty massive statement. It's like when we put something in the recycling bin, we expect it to be recycled. I don't know if I can't think of a very good analogy, but you know, when you put something in the bin, you expect it to go somewhere. You expect it to do what it says on the tin. And with recycling, that is simply not the case. This is a bigger problem in the US than it is in other countries because of a more privatized recycling system where it's not economical to recycle, whereas in other countries it's run by state utilities and therefore it can be subsidized. But then, and then obviously in lower middle-income countries, low-income countries, there's generally just not a competent recycling apparatus at all.
But I think like the big problem here is that in a lot of places, the facilities to enable sustainable recycling is not, you know, are not in place. And also in a lot of places, they don't have the capacity and the workforce to develop their recycling capabilities. And so that's why, like, when there's successful recycling, it's that they have an established system, that there's people there who can work to filter the plastic, the recyclables from the non-recyclables, because some people do not filter for that when they initially throw out their waste. And then they have an efficient setup to enable them to recycle well and to separate the different types of plastic within the system.
Yeah, definitely. And what I noticed there is that you made a sort of offhand comment, which is like when people don't separate their waste perfectly. And so I don't want to like call you out for that because that's perfectly reasonable. But the thing is that with recycling is that there's this huge impetus placed on the consumers. It's their responsibility to sort their recycling, which is fair to a point. But at some point you have to ask, why is it so difficult? Why is it so hard to sort your recycling, especially within plastics? It's very difficult to know what's recycled and what's not. And we'll get onto that later. But if you listen, just hold that thought because I've got that sorted and it's coming up soon. As I was saying, you know, the problem is people think they're recycling, and there's a big problem if you think you're recycling it, you think you're doing something good, and actually the opposite is happening. People could be imagining that, oh, I'm such a good, you know, I spend 10 hours sorting out all my recycling.
Well, it doesn't actually take 10 hours, but hopefully not.
Yeah, obviously. I'm using hyperbole as a rhetorical effect. But, you know, 10 kilometers away or 100 kilometers away or 1,000 kilometers away behind their back, it's actually just being burnt. And then, you know, they're breathing in the tiny fine particles of their incinerated plastic waste. And, you know, that's a bit mean to do that to someone that they put in this effort and they recycled. And they could generally have put recyclable plastics, you know, perhaps like a PET bottle is recyclable. I'm using air quotes here because there's no video. And it's not being recycled just because it's not economically sustainable to do so.
All right.
And talking specifically about incineration, that is a genuine problem. This is something you learn about at IGCSE chemistry, is that different plastic polymers are made of different things. But PVC, which, you know, using PVC pipes, PVC contains, it's short for polyvinyl chloride, which means that it contains lots of chloride in it. And so when you burn it, obviously the chloride gets combined with elements in the air, specifically hydrogen, which forms hydrogen chloride gas, which is not only a toxic gas, but dissolves in moisture in the atmosphere and becomes acid rain, hydrochloric acid, which is obviously not great. We all know about the terrible effects of acid rain. But I know personally here that in Oxford, that our non-recyclable plastic waste is getting burnt. In Oxford, non-recyclable waste gets sent to an incinerator. Now, I will talk about this later, and this is like actually a good example of a good way to deal with waste. But you have to be very careful about it, because if you're just burning plastic waste on the streets, the reason that it smells so bad is because it's not burning very well. It's not very good at burning quite cleanly, which means that you get a whole lot of particulate pollution. It's going to be horrific if you're burning plastic out in the open. And studies have shown, you know, PM 2.5 is really, really dangerous. These sort of fine particulate pollution, it's terrible for human health, as well as the issues from toxic gases being emitted. You know, incomplete combustion, you could get carbon monoxide. That's toxic to your blood carrying capacity.
So in terms of chemistry, would that have something to do with incomplete combustion?
Yeah, exactly. So if we think about something that combusts completely, natural gas would be a good example. And that's why it's not perfect, but that's why there's not much smoke coming off your hob, even though you're burning a fossil fuel. Something like plastic, because it's got like these long chain polymers. It's basically almost like a really, really viscous oil. So it's not, but you get what I mean, in that it's very difficult. It doesn't vaporize well, so it's difficult to burn cleanly. It's difficult to for oxygen to sort of reach all the different carbons and combine with them effectively. That's very difficult to do inside a plastic. And that's why it doesn't burn completely. And you get either soot, which is just carbon, or carbon monoxide. But also you've got to remember that they're not just hydrocarbons. It's not just hydrogen and carbon inside plastics. You're going to have more complicated things. So, you know, the simplest plastic is probably something like polyethylene, which is just a hydrocarbon, really. But as I said earlier, something like polyvinyl chloride has got chloride in it. And there are lots of other different types of plastics with different molecules in them. And when those also get combined with things in the air, you can get more harmful compounds as well. So it is definitely, from a chemistry point of view, to do with the incomplete combustion. That's why it doesn't burn so cleanly, and it will lead to particulate pollution from soot and other bad chemicals. Yeah. Hisham's gone again. He's in America. Why is he suffering from bad Wi-Fi? Jelly tots are good, though. You're back. Hi.
I'm trying to get on my hotspot so it's better. The internet shouldn't be this bad in the US, but I guess it is.
So that's what I was just saying. As we've established, since most plastic waste, even put in the recycle bin, is not being recycled, where else is it going? So if it's not being incinerated, the place where most things are probably going is landfill. Now, if landfill is not properly managed, as it won't be in most upper middle, lower middle, low income countries, it's not going to be properly managed. There's not going to be proper systems to manage the allocation of waste to landfills, basically. And often it will basically just be a dumping site somewhere outside of town. And so if it's not managed, it's devastating for the environment, this kind of plastic pollution, because, you know, the birds are eating this stuff. It gets transported around in the bird's beak. It gets dropped off somewhere else, or the wind just blows them off the top of the pile around. And, you know, it's not just like clean plastics out of a factory that's sitting in a landfill. It's really, really disgusting. They've just got a little bit of dirt on them, a little bit of food, and suddenly, you know, like, it's covered in worms and flies. It's just the most disgusting and smelly thing. I've been there. I've smelt it. It is gross. It is really, really gross. And so you've imagined like what that's like for residents living nearby. There's people living nearby. You know, there's sort of third world countries are really, really densely populated. There's going to be a lot of people subject to these disgusting smells. But another issue is that when we have this sort of decomposition in this manner, it emits a lot of methane. And as we know, methane is a very potent greenhouse gas, probably around, I said, like 100, or was it 30? I can't remember. It's about an order of magnitude worse than carbon dioxide in terms of its emissions potential, its global warming potential. It's much worse. It does degrade. Whoops, I'm putting on my phone. It does degrade within 12 to 15 years. So that means that we can sort of keep emitting methane up to, 15 years before 2050, supposedly. And then it will degrade by 2050, so there'll be zero methane in the atmosphere at that point where we want to be net zero. But alternatively, that short lifespan means that a quick way to make strides towards achieving our emission reduction goals is to stem these easily stemmable flows of methane, which is from landfills and from leaks in natural gas infrastructure. Landfills, plastic pollution, but also methane pollution is a big issue.
So the next sort of big problem is the devastation that plastic waste causes to our natural habitat. So first big point here is that microplastics are extremely, extremely difficult to remove. And projects to clean up oceans as of now have made quite minimal impact with regard to microplastics. They have removed some plastics, but, you know, they'd have to be at a much larger scale to be doing anything super big, you know, the way that they try and make themselves seem. And one of the biggest problems with microplastics as they make it into our natural habitats is, I think a lot of people think, you know, there's microplastics in the ocean. That's bad for the ocean, but oh well. But it's not just going to stay in the ocean. The ocean, it's going to come back to bite us. So what happens is the plastics break down in the ocean. Some fish eats those microplastics, and that fish is eaten by another fish, and then the microplastics work its way into that fish's systems, and then some fisherman fishes that fish, and it's put on somebody's plate, and then they eat that. And at this point, there have been recorded cases of people having microplastics in their blood, microplastics in their lungs. It's being found in human tissues, not only animal tissues. So it's coming, it's becoming a big problem for us through what we eat. So it's not just a problem for the oceans or for our natural habitats, but it's a problem for us as well.
Exactly. This is called bioaccumulation. It's exactly the same way as what happens with pesticides or chemical fertilizers, is that when they run off into the ocean or very well anywhere else, they're eaten by smaller animals. But as it works its way up the food chain, the concentration increases like many-fold each time you jump up a trophic level. So even if a fish only has, say like a krill.
Krill have been found to have a lot of microplastics. So I think actually a lot of, you know, the microplastics that end up in the kind of system, in that kind of ecosystem, do come from krill with regards to the ocean, because there have been studies that have found microplastics in krill, and krill are sort of the bottom of the food chain. If you're wondering what krill are, they're kind of like super, super small shrimp that travel in kind of large herds, and all the fish, like pretty much all life, aquatic life, big aquatic life, in the northern and southern seas is dependent on krill. So whales eat krill, fish eat krill.
If you imagine that there's, say, 3 microplastics in each krill, just a completely arbitrary number there that does not any doesn't carry any scientific weight, but say we have 3 microplastics in each krill, and a whale then, or let's have a small thing, let's say then a small fish eats 15 krill, now that fish has 45 krill in it. Round up to 50 for mathematics simplicity. And now that fish is eaten by a bigger fish, but that bigger fish is going to eat, 50 fish over its lifetime. And now we've got 2,500 microplastics in this bigger fish. And then a whale eats like 1,000 of these bigger fish. And now we have like 2.5 million microplastics inside the big fish or inside the whale. And then say it's whaling season in the Faroe Islands, and this whale gets, you know, harpooned on the beach, and then a human goes to eat that whale, and it's got 2.5 million microplastics in it. That's the power of bioaccumulation, and the human eats that whale tissue, and they're going to get microplastics in their own tissue. And so that's an exaggeration, and that's not scientifically accurate, but you understand the premise, which is that a small amount of microplastics at the bottom of the food chain drastically multiplies when you get higher up the trophic level,
and
comes to humans.
And microplastics are also super toxic.
Eating things.
And they have been found to... I mean, of course, they're super toxic. They have recently been found to be able to pass on from via breast milk, so from mother to you know, child, and that's been found in dolphins. That's been found in whales, and often what happens is that, you know, as the baby, as the microplastics accumulate in the baby's body, via the breast milk, that baby is slowly poisoned, and then over time dies. And there have been a lot of cases where now we're getting a lot of baby dolphins and baby whales dying, which is a big problem, of course. But I mean, they're both mammals, and that, you know, begs the question, you know, as we get large amounts of microplastics in our systems, are we going to be poisoning our babies by using breast milk, you know, how far does it go?
Yeah, and this is on the back of the already massive issue of poisoning from chemical pesticides and fertilizers. And we've seen cases of people like suing pesticide companies because of the massive material damage that has come as a result of the massive consumption of pesticides. And I believe pesticides, chemical pesticides, are thought to be one of the main causes of depression, in fact, as well as just being generally toxic. So bioaccumulation is a problem, whether it's microplastics or pesticides. But let's bring it back to the issue of plastic recycling with the fact that plastic is not recyclable. Metals are recyclable because metal is just a lattice of metal ions, which are held together by a sea of delocalized electrons. And what you can do if you've got any metal, if you've got any metal, you can just melt it down. The heat will overcome the forces of the delocalized electrons. You get this liquid metal, this atomic goop, and then you can reshape it into whatever you like. It's that easy. It's that simple. But plastic, meanwhile, as we mentioned before, are made of these giant polymers. And imagine it's like a bead chain, you know, it's really long. And unlike actual bead chains, the links between those beads are really, really strong. When you're going to recycle the plastic, you're not actually going to try and cut those beads, because if you did, you'd just be burning it, and you're not going to be making anything by burning plastics. And so to recycle it, you just have to sort of smush it around a bit and reshape it. And so that's actually really difficult to do. And so when you do that, you produce really low quality plastics. They're going to be very flimsy. You're not going to be making any like hard plastics out of it. And now that you've recycled this thing into a low quality plastic, it's not going to get recycled again. Like PVC is, I think, one that is a bit better. You can recycle like 7 times by doing some special techniques. But with any plastic, it is finitely recyclable. Unlike aluminium cans, which you can recycle infinitely, there is no degradation in quality. With plastics, they can only be recycled a few times. And then after that, they end up in landfill anyway.
Or in the ocean.
Exactly. Or in the ocean, which is arguably worse, or incinerated. So even if you recycle your plastics, by buying a plastic product, you're introducing, not directly, but by demanding that the more plastic be produced. When that plastic is created out of oil and out of, say, ethane, which is a component of crude oil, or it can be cracked from larger alkanes, when you introduce plastic, when virgin plastic is created, it will always end up in landfill or incinerated or in the ocean or in natural habitats. Just recycling is just, it's just holding it back. It's just saying, just wait a year, and then it still ends up in the same place. It's not recycling. It's more like a loop-de-loop. It just delays it for a bit. It's just holding it off. But it cannot prevent the eventual disposal in the environment.
The good thing about recycling, though, and even though, of course, you know, like Oscar just said, it's not any type of silver bullet, and it's not going to kind of cause a net zero requirement for us to produce more plastics. It does slow the need to produce more plastics. So as you recycle, we reduce the need for more plastics to be produced and for lower quality plastics to be produced, which is one step forward. And I would like to point that out. It is one step forward, but it is by no means the solution. And by recycling, we're not going to solve the whole plastic waste issue, because, of course, like Oscar just said, plastics can only be recycled so many times, and eventually they're going to end up in a landfill, the ocean. Yeah.
So, yeah, Hisho, that's all well and good that, you know, you say because we're recycling, it means overall, you know, say my plastic gets used 3 times, that's, you know, you only need a third of the amount of plastics we produce. But the issue here is psychological. And the fact of the matter is, and we'll touch on this later, is that because recycling exists, people, there is more demand for more plastic products. So in fact, in a world without recycling, arguably less plastic products would be made, even than if every plastic was recyclable, because people would know that it's not recyclable.
And it's because like people feel like they can hand themselves a gold star for like, I recycle, I bike to work. So like now I can buy as many plastics as I want because I'm just going to recycle it. And I can drive across the country because I bike to work. And it's like, yeah, but then it's super counterintuitive. It's like people think, oh, I'm doing such a great job that, you know, now I can compensate for everything bad that I want to do. So that's what happens often, and that's what Oscar is saying. But anyway, let's move on.
The popularity of recyclable plastics means that other plastics become more acceptable. So for example, say it's, you know, strawberries are in season, it's the summer here in the UK. So say I grab a punnet of strawberries, which is a plastic punnet. However, this plastic punnet is recyclable. And the fact that this plastic punnet is recyclable, it makes me conveniently forget that the film that you like peel off the top of the punnet is definitely not recyclable. Now in the UK, we generally have pretty good like labeling to show what is recyclable and what isn't. So I can tell, you know, this film, it says like not yet recycled. It's always very optimistic. It's like not yet recycled, but yeah, well, not currently recycled. It's a bit optimistic as if they're ever going to start recycling that sort of film. But yeah, my whole point to drive home is that because some plastics recyclable, and that's actually only a minority of plastics that are recyclable, because some plastics recyclable, generally we see all sorts of plastics as more acceptable socially and environmentally in sort of our frame of mind. And that's a psychological thing that I bet you plastic companies know and they're trying to trick us with to earn more money. The key point that I want to drive home is because people know they can recycle plastics, they are far less concerned about buying plastics. And I'm certainly susceptible to this myself. You know, there'll be something and I'll be like, my dad will be like, oh, you know, it's got plastic and we shouldn't get it. So I'm like, yeah, but it's recyclable plastic, you know. And I'm wrong there when I say that, because that's not true. And that's not a good reason to buy plastics, because plastics are always bad, whether or not they're recyclable.
Though glass also has its own, I will say as well, like, even though glass is, you know, a step forward and using paper packaging is also a step forward, it's, again, it's not like the perfect solution. It's just a little bit less worse, less bad.
This is similar that a study actually found, you know, like when people installed energy-efficient lights in their house, they actually ended up using more electricity because they just were not concerned about, like, leaving the lights on anymore, because, like, oh, it's energy-efficient lights, like, it doesn't matter anymore. And they actually ended up using more electricity than before they had when they had bad lights, which is pretty crazy to think about. But, you know, when you mull over it a bit more, it really does make sense. So, next issue. Plastic recycling is unprofitable. It used to be just like chucked in containers and shipped to China because, you know, China exports a lot of things to the US. So now there's a bunch of empty containers sitting in the US, but we need to send them back to China. So then just put a bunch of plastic in them, send it back to China. And then, like, I think it was around 2015, China was just like, wait a second, why are we just receiving like all the world's plastics? We're actually not a big fan of this. This is not very profitable for us. So I think originally, like, there were people in China who were able to recycle it on a very thin profit margin and turn it back into plastic pellets. But then I think that's no longer profitable. And China was like, we don't want to have all this waste just being shipped to us. So now it's like there's a lot of news coverage about how like shady plastic recycling is, like, even from reputable countries like the UK, it's getting shipped to like poor countries just to be dealt with and mostly just thrown into landfill when it's supposed to be recycled. It's very dodgy deals. And all of this is because it's really not economical to recycle plastics. It's just unprofitable. Why should anyone bear the cost for recycling these plastics that's unprofitable to recycle? It's difficult to sort, and the final product is bad quality compared with the very cheap virgin plastics from very cheap oil. And in fact, the plastic industry themselves, who invented plastic recycling as a solution to the problem, in an internal memo that is now publicly available, the plastic industry themselves conclude that it is uneconomical and unprofitable to ever recycle plastic on a large scale. Which brings me on to the next issue, which is lobbying by the plastic industry. So if you aren't aware, now's the time to tell you, plastic is made from oil. It is an oil product. It is a fossil fuel product. It is made by taking those sort of lovely long chain hydrocarbons from oils, and then you do some chemical magic with them, and suddenly you've got some lovely long polymers. You can do a polymerization reaction, you know, ethene into polyethylene chain polymerization. It's not that difficult, and you've got some lovely long polymers there from your oil, but it is made from oil. It is very rarely made from anything else. And that means that obviously it has the full weight of the fossil fuel industry behind them. And the plastic industry is really just an arm of the fossil fuel industry. And when plastic first popped up, it was almost entirely propped up by the fossil fuel industry themselves. And in fact, now that oil consumption is not necessarily decreasing, but looking to decrease, in terms of as people switch to electric cars and so on, the oil industry themselves have made it a primary goal to triple plastic consumption by 2050 to make up for their loss of revenue from selling oil to burn. Instead, they can sell it for the petrochemicals industry. And so a few things that they did, I'll tell you. In response to the 1970 Earth Day campaign, which was sort of against like pollution, plastic pollution, these sort of things, the plastic industry in America made like a lobby group called Keep America Beautiful, which is very ironic. And this company ran an ad asking consumers to stop throwing away the plastic. In contrast to previous like advertisements, which are like advertising throwaway living, like just throw everything away, you know, buy a new dinner table every night and just throw it in the bin. Like, it's exaggeration, but you understand what I mean. So then the plastic industry, having previously promoted the production of so many single-use plastics, even when consumers didn't want that, instead of pulling back and saying, you know what, we'll make less plastics, that's a good idea, instead of actually fixing the problem, they just shifted the responsibility, almost morally, made consumers feel guilty about the plastics that the consumers weren't even responsible for. It's a classic tactic. It's just been used also more generally in making people feel responsible for their own carbon footprint. We talked about that in episode 22. And so this ad was actually very dodgy. They got an Italian man and dressed him up as a Native American stereotype and then had him canoe down a river and feel sad about all the plastic. So you can see how dodgy that is. But yeah, the key point is this shifting of responsibility. And instead of actually doing what mattered, they just made people feel bad instead. And then in society and the way people talk about it, it's, you know, it's your responsibility. You should stop buying plastic. You should resort recycling. You should recycle more. You should whatever, whatever, whatever. It's, that's you. When actually the real issue is that there aren't really good options, because the plastic industry, the ones that are forcing us to have an option and to use these unrecycled plastics. And that's the real issue here. Another example of this would be the resin identification code. Now, if you look at any plastic, have I got plastic here? Yes, here's some plastic on my desk because my pen refills come wrapped in plastic. Now, this might not be American, so it might not have a resin identification code. In fact, no. Well, it's actually from Japan, I think. But can I find plastic? Can I find some plastic? This one doesn't have it, but which doesn't do well to serve my point. But in the US, every piece of plastic has to have printed on it what's known as a resin identification code. And what these things do is it tells you what type of plastic it is. However, when they designed the resin identification code, they designed it to look very similar to the recycling symbol, which means now everyone looks at their plastic, you know, you can hear, I've got some plastic here. They look on the bottom of it and it's like, oh, there's a little recycling symbol on it. It's not a recycling symbol. It's a resin identification code. But people look at it, they think it's recyclable and they think, oh, you know, plastics, that's not so bad for the environment. It's recyclable. And when it's not, in fact, only if you see those resin identification codes, generally only numbers 1 and 2, which is a PET. What does that stand for? Poly something. They also. And HDPE, which is high density polyethylene, are recyclable. Often you'll see number 4, LDP, is also recyclable. 5 sometimes, generally. It's just not economical too, though. And all the other types are just not recyclable, really. And so they made this code to put which they lobbied Congress to make it put on every single piece of plastic that's produced that looks like a recycling symbol, but it's actually not. Like, if that's not suspicious, I don't know what is. And the thing is that ultimately, plastic recycling was invented to sell more plastic, not less, because of the way it tricks consumers into thinking that plastic's not bad for the environment. If consumers, and this is a maybe not a quote, but a paraphrase from a plastic industry executive, if consumers think that recycling is working well, they will be less worried about the environment and they will buy more plastic. Like that is just really messed up to me. Now let's move on to the solutions. So the first point to note is that recycling is still important. Plastic still needs to be recycled. It's better to have 10% of plastic recycled than 0%. But it's important to remember, reduce, reuse, recycle is in that order for a reason. First, you reduce how much plastic you consume. Then you potentially reuse it. This is difficult to do unless it's like a multiple use item, you know, or there's stuff, you know, like use your plastic bags many times, don't just throw them out, use disposable razors more than once. But, you know, if you've got like a water bottle, you know, there's only so many water bottles that you can have in your school bag, you know what I mean? And so, you know, you reuse as much as possible. That's not, like, I'm not saying you should like cut up your plastic bottles and turn them into like
just reuse it as much as possible before you then.
And then
the next phase.
Then recycle it. It's important to remember first to reduce. It's not just like, just recycle. No, reduce, reuse, then recycle. Because it's very easy to recycle. It's not so easy to reduce. It's not very easy to reuse, but it is easy to recycle. So you've got to remember that that is the last resort,
or
not the first.
We should say it's very easy to think that you're recycling.
Yes, exactly. It's very easy to put stuff in a blue bin.
It's like we mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what can we actually do to fix the problem, right? So this is ultimately a problem that was introduced by lobbying from the plastic industry. It can only be fixed by lobbying from climate activists. We need government regulations on packaging to require more eco-friendly packaging. It's not so simple, though. It's not as simple as saying, like, all supermarkets got to sell their food unwrapped, because if you actually look at it, if you look at the data, selling food unwrapped actually leads to more waste because of how much food goes off. So there's got to be a balance that's struck between that. And it's not practical for everyone to like go to their local farmer's market. So where possible, get stuff unwrapped. But remember that if something's like coming from abroad, it's just not always possible to get stuff unwrapped. And it could be worse if the infrastructure isn't fundamentally shifted. We definitely need a ban on all single-use plastics in every country, because single-use plastics are inexcusable. Stuff like plastic straws, stuff like plastic.
One good thing that we're starting to see in terms of reducing, not entirely cutting out, but reducing single-use plastics, is stuff like plastic bags in supermarkets. Even in the US now, some of the supermarket chains are starting to charge you extra, and in some places a lot extra, to purchase and to use a non-recyclable plastic bag. And then, you know, also at the checkouts, they're starting to have like recycled plastic bags and like tote bags and stuff, which is, you know, a step forward, and can be, you know, reused for quite a sufficient lifespan. So we're starting to see some good movement in this direction, but, you know, of course it's not enough.
Yeah, yeah. So I think when I go to my local Sainsbury's now, which is a supermarket chain in the UK, it costs like 20p to buy a single carrier bag, when previously you could just take as many as you wanted for free. And so I think for 99% of people, they're not going to buy that, because 20p, that's actually quite a little extra, especially in the cost of living crisis today, to pay for your shopping. And so you may as well just say, because budget, you know. I think I once came back from Sainsbury's with like stuff stashed in all my pockets, like falling out, because I'm not going to buy a plastic bag. Why would I do that? And that's this sort of nudge theory. It's really important that you just have a small cost, and it'll fundamentally change people's behavior. Go ahead, Isha.
I'll make a good recommendation, which is, so I know there's all this, you know, reusable bags for, you know, carrying the bulk of your stuff. But, you know, when you go to the little fruit and veggie areas in the supermarket, and in a lot of those places, it's like these, you know, of course, non-reusable, thin plastic bags that, you know, in places like Malawi and India, just end up on the street. My mom bought last year these reusable bags that you can wrap, that you can like put that through the fruit and veg in so that it can be weighed and then purchased. And then you can unpack it when you get home and reuse it. And it's really practical. I think it's like recycled plastic netting, but we've been using it the whole year. It's not worn out a bit. And we just use it every time we go to the supermarket. But I mean, definitely looking for stuff like that, just keeping your eyes open to ideas and actively searching for solutions, you know, can do a great deal in reducing plastic consumption.
So another legal framework that we could use is deposits. So say I don't like this, it puts a lot of responsibility on you as the consumer, but a scheme that's quite popular in many places, often with glass bottles actually, is that when you buy, I think it's like commonplace in Germany or something, is that when you buy, say, a soft drink, you pay like an extra 10p or 10 cents, and then 10 euro cents or whatever. And then that money, that deposit, when you return the bottle, you then get paid that money back. And so you're sort of financially on the hook. You've got that financial incentive to recycle as well.
Yeah. And even in Vermont, even in Vermont, we're having that. We have that. My grandma collects all the metal cans and glass bottles. And I don't know if we have plastics in this sense yet, but we do have a lot of recyclables that, you know, especially for drinks, you know, cartons and stuff. If you return, you get back a certain amount of money because they charge extra for the purchase of that, you know, of the carrier, the container. And so that is something that's being implemented in a lot of places. I don't know if they have that. They have it for glass bottles, even in Malawi. So, you know, we are seeing that progression in some places. We're not seeing it enough with plastics, I will say, but it is, you know, starting to be implemented more and more.
So I think the best solution is shifting the responsibility back onto the manufacturers to pay for, firstly, the full life cycle emissions of their product, which means that they have to pay for the carbon offsets, for the, you know, that external, what's it called, negative externality. They have to pay for that in terms of how much the emissions from the extraction of the oil to the production of the plastic to then its use, and whatever is put in that plastic carrier, of course. And they also are financially on the hook when they produce the product. And this cost is, you know, passed down to you, and that's a good thing. But the manufacturer is on the hook financially to pay for the disposal of the plastic. And so that means that directly when a bottle is purchased, part of the money from that purchase from the manufacturer sort of has to go directly to that specific bottle. Most, how will that be dealt with after it has been consumed? Whether that's meaning that there's almost a direct one-to-one relationship in the purchase of these products and the way that you know, recycling plants are funded or disposal plants are funded. But I think hopefully this, because it's so difficult to recycle plastics financially, that will mean that manufacturers will likely reduce the plastic packaging or switch to a different form of packaging under sort of free market forces, if you like. Then, of course, we need more responsible plastic disposal generally rather than like just any old landfill or any old incineration. Specifically, if landfills are done right, they can be good for the environment. Good in a sense, as in just like not bad. Where you sort of lay down like a massive tarpaulin basically on the ground, then all the plastic goes inside and then it's sealed up. And while it's sort of alive, if you will, all the methane gets piped off and it can be used as like basically biogas. And then it's sealed up. And then after a bit, you can just use that land again and you can build on top of it. And that's not an environmental issue. So if landfill is done properly, it can be all right. Then incineration, what I was saying earlier in the episode is what we have here in Oxford is that your non-recyclable waste is sent to this plant. It's called the Ardley Energy Recovery Facility. It's in Oxfordshire in Ardley. And there, the plastic is burnt, yes, but there's this massive carbon capture system so that actually none of the harmful gases or pollutants escape to the atmosphere and those are trapped. And then the ash that's left over after burning is obviously quite disgusting. That's used in aggregate in asphalt, in road building. And so then that way, these sort of harmful plastics can be reduced to something a bit more usable. And if you think about what asphalt is, it is just made up of bitumen, which is the bottom layer in crude oil. So it's just if you burn a plastic, you'd imagine that you get something a bit similar to that, just like something goopy and full of long-chain hydrocarbons, just like bitumen would be.
But I have to ask, you know, how efficient is this capture of the gases? Like, where is it stored? Do you know how they manage it? Just out of curiosity.
No, I don't know. I mean, I assume it's probably something like what we get taught in physics, which is that you use sort of charged particles to attract the soot to the side, and then that probably just gets scraped back into the aggregate as well. But I'm not completely sure exactly how they'd go about it. And I'm not sure the technical detail would be interesting on the episode anyway.
All right, so just to sort of end this off, our final point here is just shifting our mindsets on how we recycle. So of course, keep recycling paper, keep recycling cans and glass bottles and, you know, and all these, you know, non-plastic materials, because they can be recycled economically and infinitely. But just be conscious of your plastic usage and, most importantly, try and reduce your plastic consumption.
So, for example, if you're getting some like peanut butter or jam, get it in a glass jar instead of a plastic jar. Avoid plastic wrap things, homemade concern, like instead of getting like buying a granola bar, why don't you just make some at home? Not easy for everyone. Not everyone's in a position to be able to do that. But, you know, my perception of America is like everything is wrapped in plastic. which is not true, and that's an overgeneralization. But there are a lot of things there that come ready-made that we would never dream of in other places, and I'm sure you can attest to that, Hisho.
I mean, I will say one of the things I've been shocked with is, so, and I'll just give a little, you know, brief story here, is, you know, when I was in South Africa, traveling and you know, even in some places in Malawi now, we have these compostable straws. And still, you know, then I came to the U.S. expecting, you know, of course they're going to have these compostable straws everywhere. And I think I've only seen like two compostable straws since I've been here. And I've seen a lot of straws. And they're not even like recyclable. Like they're all like one-use plastic straws. So like the U.S. is very far behind. And I will attest to that, which, you know, of course, you know, regarding plastic straws, which I know a lot of people think is like, you know, Visco girls or whatever, but it is a problem. And, you know, regarding plastic straws there, you can get metal straws, bamboo straws, or you could buy compostable straws and carry them with you. Like there are solutions to a lot of these one-use plastics that are out there, and you just have to look for them. Like I said earlier, with those plastic bags that you put the your veggies and fruits in, like we found an alternative solution for that. And like there's, you know, tote bags instead of plastic bags. Like there's all these ways, and you just have to keep your eyes open to finding these ways, because sometimes, you know, it's not going to be provided for you, and you're going to have to take the initiative to progress the community's mindset forward, which is not always a good thing that is being pushed onto us to make that move, but it is, and that's the reality of it. And so in the end, it kind of comes down to you and what you lobby for and how you act.
It's about changing mindsets. Like I was just thinking like this morning in the shower about disposable razors. They're called disposable. I certainly use mine many, many times before I threw them away, because they don't actually degrade that much upon every usage. And that's probably because I know that obviously that you can't recycle something as complex as this. Whereas with something like a plastic water bottle or whatever, that's very easy because you know it's recyclable. Just like not really worry about it, just throw it away easily. And if you change your mindset so that you just imagine that even if something goes in the recycling bin, it's just going to get incinerated anyway, that might force you to be a lot more careful about how you treat all sorts of plastic products rather than just the ones that, you know, like a disposable razor, which isn't that disposable. Yeah, I would end with a sort of quotation from I don't know who, which is like, we shouldn't talk about throwing things away because there's no such thing as a way. Everything sort of comes back to bite us in the end. And so we need to be much more careful about how we think about waste disposal, because it's very easy to think, oh, it just goes somewhere else. But where is that thing, and what are the effects of that? So yeah, with that, thank you for listening and see you next time. If you like this episode and like to see more, check us out on Spotify or YouTube. Just search Fighting Failure Podcast. If you liked this a lot, then we are on Patreon as well. And the links are all at links.fightingfailure.earth. See you next time on Fighting Failure. Thank you.
Great. All right, great. I am pausing my recording.